طفلة تمتطيه قوس قزح، طفلة تمتطيه.
Good morning, everyone, and welcome to This Week in Palestine, a weekly 45-minute segment of news, analysis, commentary, and discussion of issues relevant to the Palestinian struggle for freedom from Israel's continuing occupation and colonization of their homeland. This program presents news and analysis from the Palestinian perspective, a perspective we do not get from the mainstream media. This is John Roberts. There is growing evidence everywhere that the BDS movement is achieving results in unnerving Israel. This week, for the first time, Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu announced and then canceled an in-depth discussion of developing a strategy to counter the plethora of boycotts raining down on Israel. Netanyahu has maintained that BDS is not a serious threat to Israel, but is now beginning to realize that it needs to be dealt with at the highest levels of the government. The straw that broke the camel's back was the decision by the Dutch pension fund PGGM to divest from Israel's five largest banks due to their involvement in financing companies and groups involved in settlement construction. A few weeks earlier, the Dutch company Vitens canceled a contract with Mekrot Water Company for the similar reasons. In a meeting at Oxfam America's Boston headquarters Tuesday afternoon, local human rights advocates urged representatives of the international aid agency Oxfam to be true to the organization's principles and cut ties with their global ambassador, Scarlett Johansson, if she remained the global brand ambassador for SodaStream, a company that operates a factory in the illegal Israeli settlement in the West Bank. In Los Angeles and New York, human rights groups delivered a petition with more than 10,000 signatures to Johansson's representatives at Creative Artists Agency. The petition called on the Hollywood actress to end her relationship with SodaStream. However, this past Wednesday evening, Scarlett Johansson announced she was ending her role as global ambassador with Oxfam rather than cutting her ties with SodaStream. A statement released by Johansson's spokesperson said the 29-year-old Hollywood actress has a fundamental difference of opinion with Oxfam International because the humanitarian group opposes all trade from Israeli settlements, saying they are illegal and deny Palestinian rights, the Associated Press reported. The bottom line? Johansson chose SodaStream over Oxfam. She chose to keep her lucrative contract to be a spokesperson for a settlement business over her role as a human rights activist with Oxfam. And the fine hand of the Israeli lobby was evidenced this week in the New York State Legislature, where a bill that targets the American Studies Association over its decision to boycott Israel passed its first test, a vote in the New York State Senate. The bill, introduced by Democrat Senator Jeff Klein, the co-leader of the body, passed by a vote of 56-4. The measure prohibits colleges and universities from spending taxpayer funds on academic groups that support boycotting Israel. While the measure applies to any academic organization that boycotts countries where the New York Board of Regents has chartered a school, the focus is on Israel. A companion bill is currently being considered in the New York State Assembly. If it passes there, it will be up to Governor Andrew Cuomo to either sign the bill or veto it. The bill's passage marks the first time a legislative body has successfully passed a bill to target the ASA over its decision in December to boycott Israeli academic institutions. That decision, a landmark victory for the boycott, divestment, and sanctions movement, unleashed a torrent of opposition from Israeli lobby groups and university administrations. The bill's principal impact will fall on students or scholars from state schools who receive money from their institutions to travel to the ASA convention or to conventions held by the Native American and Indigenous Studies Association and the Association for Asian American Studies, both of which have voted to boycott Israel. The legislation also prohibits state schools from paying membership fees to the ASA. In practice, this will affect individual departments at state institutions, since departments pay membership fees, not schools themselves. Institutions violating the legislation would be cut off from state aid during the academic year the violation occurred. The legislation also has language that exempts certain kinds of boycotts, boycotts related to labor disputes, countries that are state sponsors of terrorism, and boycotts that target unlawful discriminatory practices, exactly what the ASA boycott and BDS movement is all about. Although Klein's statement claims that the legislation is in line with the First Amendment, legal advocates strongly disagree, and the bill could set the stage for future lawsuits. The Palestine Solidarity Legal Support Group's Dima Khalidi laid out the constitutional issues concerning the New York bill. The First Amendment prohibits public officials from denying public benefits as a way of censoring speech activities. These bills clearly aim to discourage expressive activities such as boycotts based on the legislator's personal disagreement with the content of the expression, Khalidi said. Painting the ASA boycott resolution as discriminatory is not only inaccurate, but also distracts from the fact that its purpose is, in fact, to protest human rights violations for which Israel is responsible and the discriminatory policies and practices of the Israeli government. These bills would be both a violation of free speech and of academic freedom, which the proposed legislation cynically purports to defend. So, BDS bills, and week by week we see how the impact on Israel is taking its toll. And that is the news this week. This morning we feature a recording of speeches by Frank Barrett, coordinator of the Russell Tribunal on Palestine, and Ilan Pape, Israeli historian and professor at Exeter University in Great Britain, who spoke at Northeastern University this past January 16th. We have featured several testimonies given before the Russell Tribunal on This Week in Palestine, and this morning we will hear more about the tribunal from its chief coordinator. And then we will hear from Ilan Pape, who will take a look at what is happening to the Zionist movement in Israel and the reaction to it throughout the world. Here is Frank Barrett and Ilan Pape speaking at Northeastern University.
Who knows about the Russell Tribunal in Palestine, or who's heard about the tribunal? Okay, so about half of the audience, great. I'm going to speak about the tribunal, so I've got about 15 minutes. It's going to be short. If you want to get more information about the tribunal, we've got a website. It's www.russelltribunalonpalestine.com. Russell's got double L. And you'll find a lot more information, including all our reports, etc. So the idea of the tribunal we started thinking about it about 7 years ago, and the idea was, I guess every activist thinks the same. You know, what can we do that hasn't been done yet? What can we do that potentially can better the struggle and can help activists in their daily struggle for Palestinian rights? So we were thinking of, something that comes up very often when you talk about Israel-Palestine to people that actually are not involved. And the response you often get is, first, what can I do about something that happens, I don't know how many miles away it's from here, miles away, thousands of miles away, something between Muslims and Jews, and something that me, as a US citizen, as a French citizen, as a European citizen, cannot do much about it, because I've got nothing to do with it. So we sort of internalized this thought that keeps popping up, and we thought that it was very important to show people that they had a part to play, whether they live in the US, in France, in Spain, in Italy, or in Micronesia. Because the tribunal, I mean, what Israel does on a daily basis could not happen without the support of the US, of course, of France, of the EU, of the UN, of corporations, and many other institutions. So that was the key starting point of the tribunal. Not to address Israeli violations of international law, is Israel guilty or is Israel not guilty, because this has been, you know, Israel has been found guilty hundreds of times by the UN, by various, you know, human rights organizations. So our point of view was that Israel is guilty, but if we think, is Israel, let's say, the bank robber, who provides the getaway car, who provides the, you know, the hiding the money, who keeps the money, who... So we started thinking about bodies, institutions, countries that we're supposed to investigate. So the whole idea about the tribunal was third-party complicity, to then be able to say to, like, citizens and to civil society, you have a role to play because your government is funding Israeli whatever science research, your government is vetoing every UN resolution when it comes to Israel, your corporation that you buy mobile phone from, shoes from, is financing settlements, is financing security checkpoints, etc. So we started 5 years ago, and I'll go over very briefly to, you know, the sessions we did. The tribunal did work like a tribunal. And again, if you want more information and if you want to see it, there's lots of videos on the website, including like a 15-minute film we recently made. So it's like a tribunal. You've got a jury and witnesses and experts that come and talk to the jury about various points, either of international law or various points, or the stories from people on the ground, the stories of people that lose their land, that lose their, you know, their trees, etc. So we had four sessions, one in Barcelona in 2010 that focused on EU complicity, one in London in 2010 that focused on corporations' complicity. Then we had one in South Africa that talked about the issue of apartheid. Are Israel practices towards the Palestinian people equivalent to the crime of apartheid under international law? And I'll come and speak about, you know, for about 5 minutes about this session in particular, because it's very relevant to the path that has taken civil society in you know, the way we talk about Israel now. And we finished in the US, in New York, in 2010, where we talked about the US complicity and the UN complicity when it comes to Palestine. So we wrapped it all up in last year in Brussels. And the idea, again, from the start, was not only to have a tribunal for 4 years and to issue reports. Actually, I've got one here. So that's one of the reports that we put together. So there's like five such books available with sort of executive summary of the findings of the tribunal. They're all sort of available from the website as well. Actually, it's not really true, but email us via the website and then we can sort something out. So yeah, the idea was not only like to put words on paper and say that our job is done. The idea was to think, now that we've found that the EU is guilty, that the US is guilty, that the UN is not playing its part, what can we do with the findings of the tribunal now that it's over? So the tribunal is now over, but it's about turning those words into concrete actions. Because, I mean, someone talked about the Veolia campaign. I can't see where she is now. Yeah. Veolia is a huge corporation, actually a French corporation, that is involved in illegal activities in the West Bank. So how we can, as civil society, help work in putting pressure, you know, towards this company to divest, to stop investing in Israel, but also how can we help lawyers to start legal action against those corporations? And how can we, civil society, via also sort of the legal tools that we have, you know, better the struggle and better the way we do things? I always remember when we went to South Africa, a friend of mine, a South African friend of mine called Mbuya Sini, told us, you have to remember that apartheid legally started in 1948 in South Africa, which is quite convenient for us. And at the time, there was no one UN resolution condemning, you know, South Africa apartheid. There was, so Mbuya Sini kept telling us, we had three words: freedom, justice, and equality. And we kept repeating that. That's what we want: freedom, justice, and equality. And the Palestinians and we as solidarity activists have got the three words, and that's what we're asking for as well. But we also have countless of UN resolutions, countless of reports by Amnesty International, Human Rights Watch, and PCHR, and B'Tselem. So we should be, and we are a lot stronger, and we should use those tools, the legal tools and the sort of moral tools to better our solidarity with the Palestinian people. So I'll just talk about for 5 minutes about the apartheid analogy, which is actually not an analogy. Because apartheid, and when we talk about Israeli apartheid, a lot of people, even allies, say South Africa apartheid wasn't Israeli apartheid. It's different. So don't say Israel is an apartheid state. And that's not what we're saying. We're not saying Israeli apartheid is exactly the same as South Africa apartheid. Apartheid in 1973 became a prohibited crime under international law that can be applied to any country as long as they fit the definition of the crime. So we're not saying Israeli apartheid is exactly the same as South Africa apartheid. There are major differences, but we are saying under international law, what Israel is doing to the Palestinian people as a whole, and we're not only talking about the West Bank, because there are differences in the West Bank and, you know, in Israel itself, the Palestinian citizens of Israel and the Palestinians in the West Bank don't sort of face the same apartheid, but they do face apartheid in general. And also by reframing it during the South Africa session and moving the issue from the West Bank and Gaza, sort of the OPT, Occupied Palestinian Territories, to the whole of the Palestinian people, including the diaspora, the refugees in Lebanon, in Syria, in Lebanon. It's like a weird, French thing coming up. If you make the issue broader, and if you talk about the Palestinian people as a whole, you realize that a minority, like the policies of, serving a minority, which is in this case Israeli Jews, is actually has an impact towards a majority, because the Palestinian people as a whole are a lot more than the Israelis. So the crime of apartheid, the definition is you have to have two distinct racial groups, and racial under international law is more like a sociological term than a biological one. So if you feel you are part of a group, it's like perceptions, you are, racial groups come into this definition. So two racial groups, and we agree that Israeli Jews and Palestinian Arabs feel, anyway, like distinct racial groups. Then you have to have one group dominating another group by the policies of a state, by its actions, etc., which is, again, on paper, factually true. But those crimes have to be systematic and institutionalized for it to fall under the definition of apartheid. And when it comes to Israel and Palestine, I mean, I don't have to explain it to you, it's very institutionalized and it's very systematic. In the West Bank, it's obvious, and it's actually worse than apartheid than apartheid South Africa. You didn't have settlers on the road in apartheid South Africa. You didn't have two legal systems in apartheid South Africa, which you have in the West Bank. You know, settlers are considered Israeli citizens, so they face, civil courts, and Palestinians face military courts, which actually don't even, fall into the norms of what a court should be. So apartheid is an issue that is crucial, and that as civil society we use more and more, because the word means something. And actually in Hebrew it's afrada, right? Jeff Alper, that some of you must know, who is the director of the Israeli Committee Against Hamas Demolition, was one of our witnesses in the South Africa session, and said that in documents, you know, Israeli official documents, the policy is called Afrada, which in Hebrew means separation, which in Afrikaners means apartheid. So again, it's very clear, and it's on paper, black and white. I mean, Adamir and the Center for Civil Rights in Israel has put together a list of more than 30 laws that are clearly discriminating against the population, the Palestinian population of Israel. So again, this is quite clear, this is institutionalized, this is systematic, and we should call it by its name, apartheid. Then if we do think that it's apartheid, the question is, as solidarity activists, what should we aim for and what should we fight for? And I'm going to, you know, finish in 2 minutes, and I think Ilan's going to talk about this further. If it's apartheid, should we call for a two-state solution that actually will entrench apartheid even more? Or should we start thinking about a common state that is a state of apartheid and that needs, and the laws of apartheid needs to be dismantled, and then we sort of can work together towards a better future? So I think this is a key point for us as activists. And again, I'm French, I don't have, you know, that's not my, you know, I don't have anything to teach the Palestinians. They will decide what they want to do. But I do think that we are a crucial turning point, because with the Kerry negotiations, with this two-state mantra and motto that is, you know, is always repeated. You know, people always say, I mean, Leila was in Brussels with me, was it 2 months ago? We went to the EU, they organized a big conference on a new framework, was it new? Yeah, new framework or something for peace in the Middle East. And like EU parliamentarians kept saying, we know the two-state solution is is impossible, pretty much. But we can only fight for the two-state solution. That's what they kept repeating. You know, they know it's not going to happen. They know on the ground it's very unlikely not to happen. But they say we can only call for a two-state solution. So I think as civil society and as solidarity activists, we should, our role is not to be pragmatic. Our role is not to say 163 states accept that Palestinians should have a state, and so we should follow the international community line. Our role is to push the envelope further and to work on a moral sort of moral high ground, and to be more radical than the people in Brussels, the White House, etc. So I'll let Ilan continue, but I do think that we really need to rethink the way we think about the future and the potential solution for both Israelis, Palestinians, and all of us, because I do think Palestine has become a symbolic issue, and that it's become like a symbol of what's wrong in this world, I think. And, you know, the reproduction of the occupation happens every day in our daily life. You know, Israeli security stuff are imported all over the world. They're imported in Mexico and everywhere. So I do think that it's, you know, yeah, Palestine is what's wrong with this world. But, I mean, solving the issue can show us, actually can open a window of a much better world for all of us. Thanks.
Good evening. Thank you for inviting us, both Frank and myself. Thank you for the organizers and all of you for coming this evening. We have both 15 minutes each, so we have to be very concise. So I hope you'll give me a sign if I cross. I'm one of these speakers that needs a calendar, not a watch, when I speak. So me and Castro have something in common. So I will stop after 15 minutes. That's one thing I can do, is speak. We live in a very bizarre moment in the history of Israel and Palestine. There's a kind of a paradox, actually two paradoxes, which I think are important to digest and record in many ways. One paradox is that there was never a moment in history as we live in today in which the very legitimacy of the Zionist project or the Jewish state was questioned by so many people around the globe. I'm not talking about governments. I'm not talking about people in power. I'm talking about civil societies. I'm talking about universities. I'm talking about trade unions. I'm talking about people who, despite their own problems at home, have an interest in things that happen abroad. Never before in the history of the State of Israel was Israel so delegitimized in the eyes of these people. And there are so many indications for that that I don't have the time to list them, but I'm sure you are familiar with this. Just to mention the last survey in Europe, which listed Israel as one of the four most hated states among Europeans, in the European point of view. What is the paradox? That the Western governments, of course, do not reflect even slightly this public perception of the state of Israel. As if what we need is actually an Arab Spring in Europe so that they would be more democratic and reflect what their people think about Palestine, not to mention what's happening here. Another paradox is that while this kind of international understanding and perception of Israel intensifies, the people, the Jewish citizens of Israel themselves, have no clear idea of this change in their international image. They still have a self-perception of not just living in a successful project, but one that is almost completed its course. Partly the reason is that despite the economic crisis in the West in 2008, Israeli economy more or less survived that crisis quite successfully. And although the standard of living in Israel has been decreased and there are numerous economic problems, especially for those who are part of the Jewish middle class, nonetheless, the sense is of invincibility, of success, or as the Haaretz journalist Amira Haas has put it very succinctly, as if the conflict is over and there's nothing to be worried about anymore in that sphere. In other words, whereas most people who look at Israel and Palestine would think that the major problem with Israel is the way it treats the Palestinians, most Israelis would say this is the least of our problem, as has been indicated in the last national elections in Israel. Not one party bothered to put the issue of the relationship with the Palestinians on its platform. It was not a topic you go into elections in Israel. It doesn't bother anyone. It doesn't concern anyone. And yet the world seems to think that this is the major problem in Israel and Palestine. And I think that these two paradoxes, and I only enlisted two, there are many more like this, have a lot to do with the language that we are employing for analyzing the situation in Israel and Palestine. And I think I would like to suggest three different words in the new dictionary. I'm sure many of you are already using that dictionary, but I would like to mention three initial words in the new dictionary. I have only three. I hope many more will follow, that I think will help to bridge over this gap between the self-perceptions in Israel, the behavior of the political and economic elites in the West on the one hand, and the reality on the ground, and as it is perceived by enlightened progressive people in the West on the other. And for that, I would also resort to the distinction between a one-state and a two-state solution, but not as a vision for the future, but far more as a way of understanding the present rather than talking about the future. Because nobody knows how the future would look like. So if someone supports the idea of a two-state solution as a vision for the future, it means that he or she are already thinking that they live in a reality of a two states. The basic idea of a two-state solution is that there is a Palestine which is occupied, and there is an Israel which occupied Palestine, which is the best we can hope for, because as we've seen from one survey in the United States, there are enough Americans who still think that maybe Israel is occupied by the Palestinians. But I think you have progressed since then. Maybe you've eaten less McDonald's and things have improved here. But this idea that Israel is occupying Palestine, and hence, therefore, if Israel liberates Palestine, you have a solution, means that you already know where is Palestine and where is Israel. And this, of course, is a false analysis and description of the reality. Haifa was also occupied by Israel. The Palestinians who were expelled from Haifa were expelled by Israel, by the Zionist movement. And they are part of the problem, they are part of the issue. And if we talk about Israel occupying Palestine in 67, it means that anything that happened before 67 is not relevant for the reality today. And of course, everything that happened in 48 is far more relevant to the reality today than anything that happened in 67. That's why it's not so much a question of what is the solution you support. It's far more important, do you understand the reality that you are looking at as a two-state reality or as a one-state reality? And if you understand, you may then suggest that the best way of changing this one state is having two states. That's okay, that's legitimate. But at least explain to us and remind us that there were no two states before. It wasn't as if there used to be two states. One was called Palestine, one was called Israel. There was a war, and Israel occupied Palestine, and all we want is Israel to go back to Israel. Maybe there is such a case, but it's not in Israel and Palestine. Maybe a war like this happened on Mars, but this has nothing to do with the reality in Israel and Palestine. But this is how American mediators, if you read their memoirs, explain the conflict. This is how most lecturers in American universities explain the conflict. This is how most lecturers in Europe start their courses on the Arab-Israeli conflict. So it starts with a lie, with a fabrication, with, or at least a totally irrelevant description of reality. Now, the way to connect to this reality is to adopt three new words in the dictionary, and Frank has already mentioned one of them. But I will start with the first word in the dictionary, and that's colonialism. And this is the hardest word or concept for us to use as activists, as scholars, as people who are interested in the conflict in Israel and Palestine. Because colonialism is a 19th century phenomenon. In many ways, it's a phenomenon that ended in the 19th century. And how do you explain to people that a 19th century phenomenon is still being exercised on a daily basis in the 21st century? Very difficult. But there's no other way of doing it. So people played a little bit with the term and call it now settler colonialism. Hopefully that would make it a bit more accessible. It's still, even settler colonialist societies like the United States, Australia, and New Zealand, the settler colonialism act itself has ended. Of course, you have to live with the outcome of the settler colonialism. But it's not the same issue if it's a matter of memorizing it, narrating it, or still struggling against it. Palestine is the only place where colonialism is still an active daily practice. As we speak, the Israeli next colonialist projects, are not just limited to the state of Palestine. In the city of Acre, there are 20,000 Palestinians who remained there after the ethnic cleansing of 1948. Israel announced a 5-year plan to evict all the Palestinians from the old city of Acre. because Israeli tourists don't like to go through the ruins of the Crusaders and see Palestinians there. So this is the five-year plan of ethnic cleansing of Acre, which is a matter, an act of colonization. In Jerusalem, Palestinians are daily evicted because new Jewish colonies are trying to develop there. In the Nakab, in the south, Palestinians are exposed to a new wave of Jewish colonization of the Negev, and so on. So colonialism is, it's probably the only place in the world where you can take students of history, and you don't have to show them films, you don't have to give them novels, you can say to them, look, as if you go to kind of an interactive museum, this is how colonialism is enacted on the ground. This is such a bizarre reality that no wonder politicians, even if they mean well, cannot relate to it. Unfortunately, some of our best friends in the solidarity movement cannot relate to it, maybe for the same reason, because it's beyond human comprehension that something that happened 150 years ago all over the world and ended can still be reenacted on the ground. But we need to use the term colonialism in conjunction with Zionism. And we should insist that as we were allowed as a movement against apartheid in South Africa to reject apartheid as an ideology, not just a policy by South Africa, not just a policy, but we were demonstrating against the very nature of the regime, against the very nature of the ideology which became the infrastructure for that regime. In the case of Israel and Palestine, this is amazing, including some of our Palestinian friends, ask us, you cannot demonstrate against Israel as such. You cannot demonstrate against Zionism because that means you demonstrate against Judaism. That means you are anti-Semitic. So you can only demonstrate against an a-Israeli policy. Well, then don't ask yourself, if that's the only thing you do, why nothing's changing on the ground? If you are not going to start to take every act as an act against the very ideology of the regime, against the very essence of the colonialist nature of the regime, then the struggle is in vain. And we have wasted 30, 40 years of blowing to the air futile words which had nothing to do with the reality on the ground. We have to do our own accounting as a solidarity movement, especially those of us who were, for good or for bad reasons, were unwilling to say that the problem in Israel and Palestine is Zionism, not the Israeli occupation of the West Bank and the Gaza Strip. The second term is the term of ethnic cleansing. Ethnic cleansing is a crime against humanity in the international law. And it's very well defined, especially by the American State Department, ever since the war in Yugoslavia. If you go to the website of the State Department, you will see a description of ethnic cleansing that fits like a glove to a hand, to the situation in Palestine ever since 1948 and until today. It's quite incredible. But what is incredible is the language used by the American State Department to describe an act by which the only reason a person is removed from his home, from his homeland, from his land, from his business, if the only reason is the ethnicity of that person, even if this person has left the house and is not allowed to come back, the website says, this is akin to the highest crime against humanity, like genocide. Israel as a state perpetrates this crime almost hourly against the Palestinians. So if we cannot connect the criminal act to the criminal, to the moral judgment of the State Department, we have to find out what are the blocks on the way. What are the blocks on the way? Because the language there is clear. The act is clear. The definition of the crime is clear. The crimes are recorded very clearly. And they still continue as we speak. And because we are not going to be captivated by the two-state idea, we are not moving between Israel and Palestine as peacemakers are, because we are in the same place. We know that the ethnic cleansing in Akka and the ethnic cleansing in the Nakab and the ethnic cleansing in the Galilee and the ethnic cleansing in Hebron, Halil, is the same ethnic cleansing. Namely, the only crime the people who are evicted have committed is being Palestinians. That's the only crime, according to the Israeli own testimony. People are not evicted because they did anything. People who did something, like throwing stones or planting a bomb or participating in a real act of guerrilla, are being imprisoned. Or their houses are being demolished. The Israelis have a clear repertoire of how to punish people who do things that they don't like. Removing you from your house is not a retaliation for a punishment. It's not a punishment. According to the Israeli policymakers, you are being removed because Israel has a demographic problem. That's the language. We have to have these automatic translators in our pockets. Whenever the Israelis talk about demographic problems, we should make sure that everybody who listens to them understands that they are talking about ethnic cleansing. As we did for targeted killings, when they used all kinds of launderettes of words to make sure that we are not describing reality for what it is. The last, term, I would just repeat something that Frank has said. Of course, apartheid is an important word in our dictionary. Not because it's exactly the same or not exactly the same. Of course, there are similarities and dissimilarities between the two regimes. Far more important for me than the question whether the two apartheid systems are the same is maybe something that would take us out from the academic interest in comparing the two regimes. And that is the word of regime change. This is a very legitimate term in America. Listen, and we are peaceful people. We don't want the Americans to use force in order to change the regime. We don't want people to bomb Tel Aviv. We have too many nice friends there. Every community that is represented here has nice friends in Tel Aviv. We know. We don't want people to be bombed. But we want a peaceful change of regime. Because if we are not going to have a peaceful change of regime, or if we are going to have a two-state solution, we will continue to have this gap. The third paradox, which I haven't mentioned, with this I would end, between a discourse about peace, a peace process that really provides careers and a good sense, a career and a source of living for so many people around the world. The so-called peace process has really held on an industry of scholarship, diplomacy, and wasted money of people to people in the vicinity of millions and millions of dollars. Because it had no relations to the reality on the ground. This is a rare historical example where 60 years of talking about peace, exercising a peace process, participating in a peace process, had nothing to do with the reality on the ground. That's the third paradox, that you have so much energy, so much money, so many careers connected to something which is called the peace process, but it has nothing to do with the object of the peace process, Israel and Palestine. And this gap between what you talk about and what the reality is, again, needs language to connect between the two. And the language is the language of apartheid, colonialism, ethnic cleansing, and regime change. And if we will accept these four terms, we will also easily connect to the only methods we have as a society to change regimes in a peaceful way, by exerting pressure from the outside in the form of sanctions, of boycotts, of divestment, of sending a message that as long as the regime remains, it is illegitimate in our eyes, and we will do all in our power to change it from within and from without, and then we can talk about peace. We don't want peace now. What we want now is an end of a regime which colonizes, oppresses, and ethnically cleanses the people of Palestine. Thank you.
That was a presentation by Frank Barrett, coordinator of the Russell Tribunal on Palestine, and Israeli historian Ilan Pape, speaking at Northeastern University. And that is all the time we have this morning. Thank you for listening to This Week in Palestine, a weekly feature of Truth and Justice Radio. You will find us here at WZBC 90.3 FM every Sunday morning at 8 a.m. You can also stream us live at www.wzbc.org or listen to us at any time via the WZBC archive found on the homepage. Simply go to www.wzbc.org, click on Archive, and go to Sunday Morning, 8 a.m., and click on Listen. Each program is on this archive for 2 weeks. And this is John Roberts wishing you a good morning.